Okay, so we were asked to analyze a few different issues related to okay, I'm not going to touch anything. So I guess the progress we've made so far is coming up with a couple of toy models to analyze different aspects of this issue regarding tunneling. The problem we focused on is the cavitation problem, or the problem with the collapse of the Earth above the tunneling. And we focused on statics because everything seems to be very slow in the tunneling apparatus, and so we're assuming that there's just some force balance that's leading to a collapse at some point. And so the first toy problem we set up is where we have, well, the tunnel boring machine down here. On the Earth's surface, which is up there, we have basically stress-free condition. On the upper and lower surfaces of the tunnel, there's, no normal displacements, and then free slip condition. And these two, sigma and p, represent the stresses imposed by the cutter and the pressure of the air that's blown in to try to support the structure as it's being carved away. And these are prescribed. And so the idea is now to solve this problem such that the surface displacements are within tolerance. So what is it, 1 to 3 centimeters or so, right? Another constraint we want to impose is that we don't have too much stress on the interior structure here, because one of the failure mechanisms is where a water main breaks and soaks the earth. So this is one problem that we set up and we're trying to solve. We can solve sort of the out here is a basic state with zero displacements. Out here is a perturbed state with a tunnel running all along in infinite in both directions. And so this would define the asymptotic condition as x1 goes to infinity. And now we're going to try to concentrate on solving the full problem, either numerically or in some asymptotic limit. But we haven't made a whole lot of progress in that problem yet. And the second toy setup that we're looking at, see, these are the questions that I already identified that we're trying to answer. How we choose sigma, so the cutting stresses, and P, the pressure that's being fed into the front of the machine, such that these two conditions are met, 1 and 2. And the second toy problem is now looking at a different geometry. So now we're looking endo at the boring machine, where this is the front face of the boring machine. This is the boring machine here, and it's cutting around. You probably can't see the little dot there, can you? There, you can see the hand. This is rotating, and it's cutting away the earth immediately around it, so it's essentially imposing a shear stress. And the idea is that this interior region here, region 1, is rendered plastic. So it's gone beyond yield and it's now a plastic medium. Out here is an elastic medium. And the question is, given a fixed shear here and given some interior pressure here, how big will this region extend to? So how big will this plastic region extend to? With the idea that if it gets too close to the surface, then this would result in a collapse. And we need, of course, some sort of model for the plastic region. So we've assumed the Coulomb model. And so here's the relationship for the stress tensor elements. And now solving, if you believe the solution, we of course believe the solution entirely. With that fixed torque in the middle imposed by the cutter and the fixed pressure, we get this. One gets this. One remains unnamed, but one gets this. So the idea is this implicitly prescribes a relationship between R, which is the radius that plastic region, the region which would lead to collapse if it gets big enough, and tau, which is the rotation rate, the torque inside imposed by the cutter, the tangential stresses imposed by the cutter. We haven't made much sense of it yet, and so this is sort of where things stand at the moment. There are other toy problems that we're discussing and parceling out as time goes on, but actually we're a little short-staffed. So consider this an appeal for more bodies in the room, particularly those who are a little more familiar with continuum mechanics and or granular flow than I am. So that's where things stand.
Where in the tunnel does the collapse take place? At the forehead or further back?
Well, the answer is yes. So the mechanism we're, well, the location that we're focusing on is right at the forehead, so right here. Apparently these collapses can occur something like 200 meters in advance of the machine as well. But we're focusing on something critical happening here. It can propagate due to the soil matrix for, you know, large distances by the time it reaches the surface, but that's not such a concern. What we're focusing in on is this part right here for the moment.
In this problem one,
yep,
you are treating it two-dimensional.
Yeah.
You're not using cylindrical coordinates or cylindrical. Okay.
For now.
For now. Okay. Okay.
In a month or so, we'll get to 3D.
Thanks.
Okay. Can I have a second speaker, please?
Yeah, go ahead.
Should I have used the thing that's in the key? Okay, that's fine.
Do you want to use? You can draw on this.
No, I don't have
it.
No,
no.
Okay, great.
Hello? Okay, today is first day. Major contribution is, I should say, major achievement, I should say, 4-5 cups coffee, lunch, these are major contributions, and plus, major achievements, plus, we have some other achievements. Actually, Saeed has a problem that, basically, this problem is related to influenza virus, that's in the population level, how it spreads, and the major problem is he has different kinds of treatment. I mean, whether people, all the people have to be treated in the beginning or end, or how they are. He wants to get some solution about the optimally how we can treat them. So, what we did today is actually, we have a model. For the model, what we have done is, this is the, we divided the, we are trying with the deterministic model, anyway, that's simple. So then we divided the population into susceptible, and we have three infectives. First one is infective untreated, undiagnosed. Second one is infective treated, and third one is infective resistant to drugs, not the virus, resistant to drugs. And the last one, we have the recovered class, and also we have this death. So dynamics goes like this. The susceptible can be infected, and also it can be infected with the resistance only. If the already resistant ones infect the susceptible, that becomes the infected with resistant drug. So this infected can go to the treatment class, recovered class, and death class. Similarly, this treatment treated infected can go to the recovered, death, and resistant. And this one, this resistant, can go to the recovered and death. Based on this, simple OD middle, we all know that. So here, the first one is that's the infected. These all are susceptible class gets infected. We just use the mass actions for simplicity. And mainly, I would just like to say this time, mainly that the P in the second equation and third equation, P is the treatment. It's the P-I-U is the number of the people treated. So, and so this is the dynamics, this is the model we are going to use. That we have a model now, actually we solve it, we try with the different parameters, and we try to discuss with sides whether parameters are good or not. So we solve it model, we have solution for that. Now we want to do the optimal control formulation for this. Basically our control variable is of course treatment, that P. We want to see this P we take as a function of time, and how this P varies over the time for the optimal goal. So optimal, what is our optimal goal? Is optimal objective function can be anything actually. What we want to do now is first possible thing is death. We can for the fixed time intervals we want to save the total number of death, or it could be total number of resistance, or it could be both, or it could be many more actually. There are a lot of things we can do. So then we have a major constraint here is this is the total number of treated infected plus total number of treated infected with the resistant 1D. Very interesting thing is this portion is not in the equation, but we have in the constraint. The reason is that this is the person, when we treat, we don't know the person is already resistant or not. So that's why we will be treating, and that's actually waste of our amount source. So this is the source, whatever we have here. So this is what we did, actually. And now tomorrow, we hope to solve this optimal problem.
In the first equation, it seems there's a second order reaction between the S's and the I sub R's that's turning S's into I sub R's. Is that right? How would a susceptible get turned directly into a resistant person?
Yes, that's what I was saying. That's because there might be some people resistant already in the, so when they get become resistant, and when they infect the susceptible, resistance means it's the mutant virus, resistant to the drugs. It has a new kind of resistance. And when you infect the susceptible, they will get that kind of virus, which is already resistant to the drugs. Okay.
Time for one more question, sorry. Any other questions? Yes.
How do you define your chemical T?
Yeah, it is actually, especially what we are thinking is, what we want to do is, especially during the pandemic, we kind of have a sense that how long this pandemic will last. So this is basically for the policy making. So in the policy making, let's make a policy for 16 months, 16 weeks or whatever. We can vary that, but we'll fix that time. So what we want to do is, during that time, we have this amount of source, and using this, what will be the optimal way of treating them? Whether we should treat right at the beginning, more or end, or in between where it is. So that's what we want to do that actually. So, but we are, you're right, we have to fix that. This month is the one we want to do. That's right.
Okay. Let's have a third talk, please.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is on. So today I'm going to talk about the semiconductor problem that we're studying, and this was presented by Will Shoulders yesterday from the NXP company. Okay, so I wanted to just start out by reminding you what our application is. We're looking at a circuit simulation. So it's a simulation of printed circuit boards or PCBs, and we have interconnects as well in the simulation. The mathematical model is Maxwell's equations that we need to solve. And in order to solve these PDEs, you need to discretize them. And we're using the boundary element method to do this. Now, this isn't the focus of the problem, but this is just the setup. So we have these equations. They're discretized using the boundary element method. And the ingredients for that are meshing, of course, and we have a variational form of the equations which we've discretized. Now, you might wonder, why are we doing the boundary element method instead of, say, the finite element method? So we talked a lot about that this morning. The idea is the finite element method, it might seem simpler, but it yields very large, sparse matrices. So sparse matrices are nice, but the actual size of the matrices you get is just too big. Because we're going to hook this up to a circuit simulator, and so we have sort of a maximum size matrix we can handle. So if we were to do this using the finite element method, we just get matrices that are too large. So if we do the boundary element method instead, we get smaller matrices, and they're dense matrices. And the big difference just comes from how you handle the modeling. So the finite element method, you have to look at the magnetic field and electric field. When you switch to the boundary element method, you're using Green's functions. So we get these smaller matrices, but really the matrices still are very large. And so the focus of our problem is doing model order reduction to get a smaller problem. But first, let me remind you, of course, what the mathematical equations are. So we have our circuit simulation. And we actually look at the physical laws. We have Ohm's law and Kirchhoff's law. We can write them down as a linear system of equations here. So we have these two equations, and I have the key at the bottom. So R is resistance. S is a complex frequency. And I want to highlight the fact that S is not a fixed value. It's actually a parameter. And so that's going to be an important part of our study with our simulation. L is induction. I is current. P is the incidence matrix, B is voltage, C is capacitance, and J is applied current. So a lot of these physical terms coming in from electronics. And these various things, except for S, are matrices. Okay, so this is a linear system we need to solve. And as I mentioned, the focus of our work is model order reduction. And again, it's because we're hooking this up to a circuit simulator. So we want to perform model order reduction on our linear system. And there's a couple of different classes of approaches. So there's mathematical approaches and there's physical approaches. And so we were sort of looking at the different approaches. And we started off with the mathematical ones. So one technique that Will's presented to us so far, he has seen the use of the Schur complement from numerical linear algebra to actually try to reduce the size of the linear system. So that's one possible approach. One of the main questions here he's posed that we could try to solve is, if you remember back to our linear system, we talked about, or it was on the slide, I guess I didn't highlight it, but the matrices R, L, and C, they were symmetric positive definite matrices. So the question is, if we apply some mathematical approach and reduce the order of our system, make it smaller, are we going to get anything like this when we're done? In other words, can we have a smaller system where we have some R hat, L hat, and C hat that are still symmetric positive definite matrices? Okay, so the reason I'm talking about this in terms of supernodes, we have this represented in terms of a graph, and we pull out nodes. And the ones that we don't pull out, they're supernodes. Those are the ones that are left. And I'll show you some pictures at the end. Okay? So we first analyze this for the easier case when S is equal to 0, and we were trying to figure out how to extend this to the case when S is non-zero. So that was a mathematical technique we looked at so far. We also looked at the physical approach. So the idea there really is, can we find matrices R tilde, L tilde, C tilde, such that I can actually have a smaller system, but I can actually create a circuit for it? So one of our problems we've seen is that sometimes you can apply these mathematical techniques, but at the end of the day, you can't generate the circuit. So the other approach is, can we try to make the circuit, and then later worry about what the mathematical properties are? So we're looking at it from two different viewpoints. And of course, we need to have a physical system that's realizable, but also stable. So some of the ones that they've been able to generate in the past have been realizable but not stable. And one of the main issues is how to determine these supernodes. Okay? So we have a lot of graph theorists in our group, and we sort of came up with this graph theory question, which is related to the things that these two questions we're trying to answer. So the issue really is, how can we amend our graph of the external nodes so that we can have as sparse of an inverse matrix as possible? So this is trying to formulate again as a graph theory problem. And while we do that, though, we still need to preserve the accuracy of the solution. So if you take out things from the graph, you still have these resistance, capacitors, so on. You have to, you can't change the physical laws of the system. So we're looking at how can we do that, and we looked at a particular node removal rule to try to figure out, what it meant physically. And our intuition is that the diameter of the graph is going to affect the sparsity of the matrix. Okay, so this is our main ideas for our approach so far to solve the graph theory question. So we want to delete all nodes that obviously don't play a role, and I think this will become more clear when I show the picture in a second. Step two then is once we've done that, we want to find some bridge nodes and separate them. And then lastly, remove the internal nodes and the various components that we identify from the bridges. So let me show you a picture. I'll skip this part about the remaining because I know I'm short on time. So let's go straight to the picture now. All right, so this is an example of a real network, okay, a very complicated situation. Now we're trying to look at smaller networks first, so let's look at a smaller example. Okay, so here's an example of a network we're dealing with. These nodes that you see, there's some red nodes that have the boxes around them. These are the external nodes, the nodes we want to keep in our network, but we can remove some of the other ones, and we have to do so in an intelligent way, right? We have to figure out what intelligent means, but for example, we were talking about there's a bunch of nodes near the top that, that are not near any of the red nodes. And so they're not playing a role, really, in terms of the physics and so on. We could take out a lot of those nodes as our step one. And then the bridges are these areas near these components that are connected by just, say, they look like bridges in a city. So we're calling those bridge nodes. So we want to identify those, and we can try to sort of break apart the various components. So that's our idea. And here's another picture of just another network we've been dealing with, for an example. Okay. Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So Susan, if you exclude those remote nodes, can you tell something about preservation of passivity, which is...
We haven't gotten to the passivity yet. It's a key part, but we've been struggling with a lot of the other issues, and we don't have our definition of passivity yet.
Because even though they may be remote, but they may play some role in passivity.
They might. We haven't gotten to that part yet. So ask us that question tomorrow, maybe.
Yeah, I have a question.
Okay.
How do you know that you can write your system the way you do initially with your matrices? I talked about this over lunch with some people. I mean, if you have a parallel set of wires, I mean, you basically have like a non-linear problem. Why do you feel that you can sort of break it down with this linear system?
Okay, so you're dealing with going from the non-linear to the linear. I think, well, if we do the full circuit simulation, it does come into play with the non-linear part, right? We're focusing on linear. I think this is a good question for Will. We haven't addressed this yet in the group, but can you give a better answer than my answer? Okay. So just...
Can you repeat what he said?
Okay, so he was just saying that the Maxwell's equations are linear, so just going from the PDE, discretizing, you just have the linear system of equations. But so it's when you do the circuit simulation that the nonlinear part comes into play.
Okay, well, I thank Susan. Can I get Sanjay's group? Anti-HIV?
So I'm afraid I have no pretty slides, but I do have a pad of paper. So we have been looking at the HIV problem and focusing on a bit of the pathway that was discussed yesterday, associated with NF-kappa B production and binding and use by DNA. And we've been suffering a little bit from contradictory experimental data and also other data which just sort of says there's more of protein X around when something happens than when something else happens. And the experimental papers that we've got are also at odds in some places with previous modeling papers. So what we've done is made a little caricature problem. Well, I say we, Sanjeev wrote it up, and then we've been working on that. And the caricature problem goes something like this. We've got a nucleus, and we've got area outside the nucleus. And in here, we've got a little strand of DNA. We have some, please, if I get this wrong, guys, correct me. We've got some NF kappa B out here. and that comes into the cell, runs along the DNA, and plops out some messenger RNA. You probably can't read my handwriting with that, sorry about that. Squiggle for IKB. This IKB then comes outside. And this combines with this to make a complex. And that's all very nice, but you've also got another little protein around called IKK, and that combines with the complex to sort of reverse that reaction, but it doesn't quite reverse it because in the process it destroys the IKB. So we don't have concentration of IKB in this, but we do have the amount of NF kappa B between all the different species conserved. So from this little cartoon, we wrote down, well, we did the obvious thing, wrote down 5 ODEs for each of the things that are going on. So it's not an ODE for this, we just assume that's given at a certain concentration. We use conservation of NF kappa B to reduce that to 4. We found the steady states and found that there's 1, it's stable. Kate then plonked this onto her computer and we got some real in inverted commas, i.e. somebody else had come up with the numbers, so we've got someone else to blame, set of parameters, plonked it on the computer and solved it, and then got a graph that agreed with an experimental plot that was in one of the papers, so that made us very happy, and Sanjeev then jumped up and down and said we're fantastic and all that kind of thing. And what she's now doing is incorporating that into a model that she has for viral load. Was it viral load? Yeah. So that's nothing to do with the question Sanjeev asked us, but it's just something fun that that Kate decided she wanted to have a go at. Other models that are around other than our one, well, there's one that's got 27 ODEs in, another one which has 7 where they reduce it to 3. So you might say, how does this model compare with those? So we haven't touched the 27 ODE model with a barge pole because, 27 ODEs is a big long thing to write up. And so we have looked at the 3 ODE model and reproduced the simulations in the paper that's got that in, and that shows oscillations, whereas our model doesn't. So there's some interesting things for us to think about tomorrow. Also tomorrow, Sanjeev is going to give us some more pathways and some more proteins to build this up. Remember, his original picture had 70 lines on, so we're starting small and going bigger. And also, if we're feeling courageous tomorrow, we might start with the 70 and try and get smaller as well. And what we've done is set Sanjeev some homework of figuring out exactly which bits of biology he wants to plonk into this for tomorrow so that we don't have a big row for about 2 hours at the start of the day. So thank you, that's all I've got, and the rest of the team will answer any questions that you have. Splendid.
I'll step down there. Okay, the next group is Maple Ridge. Oh man, no computer.
First, I'll explain what the Maple Ridge problem actually is and the problem that they're facing right now. So what they have is like they have 35 strategies, right? And they have a data set of size 2607 days. And they use the data size of 1500 days to estimate the mu and the covariance matrix for the 35 strategies. And then use this mean and covariance matrix to find the optimal weight of the portfolio for the rest of the data. And what they find is that equal weighting of the strategies actually, the most counterintuitive result, that equal weighting of the strategies gives them the highest Sharpe ratio. Sharpe ratio is actually the mean adjusted return. Like you have return seen over the rest of 1107 days. So the Sharpe ratio will be the mean for these 1107 days by the standard deviation. And the counterintuitive result they're getting is that the Sharpe ratio for the equally weighted strategies is much more than the Sharpe ratio they get from the Markowitz portfolio optimization. So like we have done a number of numerical experiments in this direction. Like for example, if we have correlated Brownian motion and if the standard deviation of the Brownian motions come out to be much more than the mean mu, then the Markowitz portfolio theory has a large instability, a large degree of instability. And the data they gave us is also plagued by non-stationarity, a term used in time series, because the mean mu and sigma themselves are stochastic processes. Right, so this in fact gets, so the weight we put over here, we can't continue it for the rest of the period. We need to continuously rebalance the portfolio by a certain stop in time. And that's, so it's like, so once you're at this point in time, and you apply the Markowitz portfolio theory based upon your mean mu and sigma, say based upon the past data, you have a certain stopping time tau 1 given the transaction costs and the mean mu and sigma, which are stochastic variables, and this time tau depends upon mu and sigma, it gets a certain probability distribution. So we have framed it as a stochastic, so how to allocate our wealth between different strategies with stochastic mean and covariance matrices such that you maximize the growth rate of the portfolio given the transaction cost. So it's like we have converted the problem into a dynamic asset allocation problem. And I think we can make a lot of progress in this direction. If you have non-stationary data and the mean and the covariance matrix is stochastic, we need a dynamic asset allocation. And right now the model is very simplistic. We need to introduce a number of other factors, how to maximize the growth rate, minimize the drag down of all that, and let's see how the progress in this direction.
Next is Pascal Sutkin.
I don't have a fancy presentation either. We've been in the basement looking at brains. That was the only reason I agreed to give this talk, because I wanted to start it with that joke. So the physical problem that we're looking at is we have a brain, and inside this brain there are lots of things that are magnetic dipoles, and these guys are firing all the time, and we have a set of sensors around the outside of this, and these sensors can detect the magnetic fields that the dipoles are creating. And the dipoles are firing all the time, and what we're interested in is when, so occasionally these dipoles, some dipoles will start to fire kind of in sync, so they'll be synchronized. And that might, so that might just be happen, that happens kind of fairly sort of, you know, for a short period of time, maybe for half a second they'll sort of come into sync and then they'll go out of sync. So we're interested in being able to detect those events, so those synchronization events. So the three, I actually wasn't in the room for all of the time, so some, maybe people want to jump in at some point. But I think that, so the three things that kind of that we've been looking at are, first of all, so we've got all these measurements on the outside. So how does what we're measuring on the outside correspond to what's going on the inside? So basically, can we solve the inverse problem to determine what's going on in the middle there? And so the starting point for that is that we have sort of a fairly simple formula that says, given a dipole here, we can write down what we should be able to measure up here. So, and today we've kind of formulated the forward problem, and it looks possible that we might be able to solve the inverse problem. The second thing that we've spent a lot of time talking about is what does it mean for two events to be synchronized? We've talked about smoothness. I don't understand what smoothness is or what. I keep not paying attention. But just defining mathematically, so these things are kind of, you've got signals sort of at these dipoles all the time. Defining mathematically what it means for there to be a synchronization event is non-trivial. And then we've been also thinking about, well, really looking at kind of what Lewis is at the moment in terms of how he measures a particular definition of synchronization events. That's it. I think that's it. I can answer questions.
So does anybody have any questions for us?
Yeah.
What do you mean exactly when you say the dipole is firing?
So from what I understand is that this is inside the brain, and there's electrical activity, and there's things which are happening, and that's meaning that you get a magnetic field kind of so you get this dipole which creates a magnetic field, and it's fluctuating all the time, and you're getting a magnetic field that's not coming in. So firing could mean, firing could mean kind of it comes on, but it could also mean that you get kind of, you know, a set of oscillations and then something else. So we're looking for correlations between either, you know, maybe kind of an on off event, or correlations between a let's fire a series of pulses event.
Anyone else? Okay. Next talk is very good.
Hello? Okay. Okay, so the group that I was a part of was looking at target date mutual funds. And they're different from mutual funds because usually those are just done on a one-year basis and then rolled over. But the target date mutual fund will actually automatically adjust your exposure to equity over time. And now, due to different changes in government policy regarding default options on company pension plans, these are becoming more popular. So it's becoming more important for employers to be able to rank different target date mutual funds. Now, why Manulife might be interested in this is because they have their own target date mutual fund and wants to be able to give some sort of a measure of how good it is, like some sort of ranking system. So, it's a little bit different than just evaluating a portfolio manager's performance, because they will usually there'll be many years of data to be able to evaluate a typical one company's sort of performance of a particular fund. But we don't really have that sort of historical data to be able to evaluate different companies' target date funds. So we're really just given two main pieces of information that we can use to evaluate the funds. And one thing is called the glide path. And that is just your exposure to equity. So you have time. The target date is usually retirement, or some, usually it's every 5 years, target date, so it's probably the closest to your estimated retirement. But then you have, proportion of your income that's invested in equity. Proportion of your income invested in equity. And this is adjusted over time. And different target date funds will have different strategies for how this glide path sort of evolves. And usually it's something like that. Okay, so instead of the first thing that we decided to do is to actually find out, well, what's the optimal glide path, and then maybe that will help us to be able to rank the different target date funds. All right. So this was actually solved by someone named Merton in the 70s. And so he's in through his paper, and he uses stochastic control theory to do this. And what he ends up with is that the optimal strategy is actually a constant exposure to equity. And this constant, well, what's not invested in equity is invested in, you can consider either a risk-free asset or a fixed income asset or bond, whatever. Okay, so Merton found that this should be constant, and the actual value of that constant should be is determined from the particular investor's aversion to risk. Okay, but that doesn't take into consideration something that's really important to consider, and that is human capital. And when I say that, I'm talking about your future earnings. So as time goes on, and you make money, then that gets actually that goes into your wealth. So as you keep going, that amount of future income that you'll have, total future income will decrease. And if you can, and if you think about, if you assume that future income is a relatively sort of sure thing, I guess, then you can consider it like, well, you can add a small sort of a volatility, or you can have that correlated to the market volatility or whatever. But if you consider that it has a low volatility, then you can think of that like your human capital as being that amount of money really invested into a bond. So what you actually see then, if you do the stochastic optimal control problem for that, then you do see what you really do see in target date funds, which is this sort of decreasing exposure to equity. So now what we're doing is we're going to incorporate some extensions to this. One of them is to write a more realistic model for labor income. Another one is to add different types of equity classes. One thing I didn't say at the beginning was that this proportion invested in equity we do actually know, the fund will tell you what sort of equity classes that is. Like, they'll tell you if what's going to be invested in large cap, small cap, emerging markets, different geographical locations. Is this just a Canadian, invested in Canadian stocks, for example? So there may be different classes. And so we have different proportions that will need to vary over time. So that's an extension. And then in terms of evaluating target date funds, we're going to look at different utility functions that may make it more realistic, and then use some Monte Carlo simulations to then evaluate some sample funds. That's all.
Any last questions before we close it off or anything? Great. Oh, yeah, great. Okay, thanks, Ashley.
Thank you. Yes, I think so. Thank you.
Thank you.